Roman literature, Cosimo supported the rebirth of interest in antiquity that was at the core of Renaissance humanism. He founded and funded Florence's first public library and the influential but informal Platonic Academy, where scholars and public intellectuals discussed the classics. In art, he was a patron of Fra Angelico, Filippo Lippi, and Donatello. Cosimo died in 1464, just as Leonardo arrived in Florence from Vinci. He was succeeded by his son, and then 5 years later, his famous grandson, Lorenzo de' Medici, aptly dubbed Lorenzo the Magnificent. Lorenzo had been tutored in humanist literature and philosophy under the watchful eye of his mother, an accomplished poet, and he patronized the Platonic Academy launched by his grandfather. He was also an accomplished sportsman, distinguishing himself in jousting, hunting, falconry, and breeding horses. All of this made him a better poet and patron than he was a banker. He took more delight in using wealth than in making it. During his 23-year reign, he would sponsor innovative artists including Botticelli and Michelangelo, as well as patronize the workshops of Andrea del Verrocchio, Domenico Ghirlandaio, and Antonio del Pollaiuolo, which were producing paintings and sculptures to adorn the booming city. Lorenzo de' Medici's patronage of the arts, autocratic rule, and ability to maintain a peaceful balance of power with rival city-states helped to make Florence a cradle of art and commerce during Leonardo's early career there. He also kept his citizenry amused with dazzling public spectacles and grandly produced entertainments, ranging from passion plays to pre-Lenten carnivals. The work done for these pageants was ephemeral, but it was lucrative, and stimulated the creative imagination of many of the artists involved, most notably young Leonardo. Florence's festive culture was spiced by the ability to inspire those with creative minds to combine ideas from disparate disciplines. In narrow streets, cloth dyers worked next to gold beaters, next to crafters of lenses, and during their breaks they went to the piazza to engage in animated discussions. At the Pollaiuolo workshop, anatomy was being studied so that the young sculptors and painters could better understand the human form. Artists learned the science of perspective and how angles of light produce shadows and the perception of depth. The culture rewarded above all those who mastered and mixed different disciplines. Brunelleschi and Alberti. The legacy of two such polymaths had a formative influence on Leonardo. The first was Filippo Brunelleschi, 1377 to 1446, the designer of the cathedral dome. Like Leonardo, he was the son of a notary. Desiring a more creative life, he trained to become a goldsmith. Fortunately for his wide-ranging interests, goldsmiths were lumped together with other artisans as members of the Guild of Silk Weavers and Merchants, which also included sculptors. Brunelleschi's interests soon embraced architecture as well, and he travelled to Rome to study classical ruins with his friend Donatello, another young Florentine goldsmith who later achieved fame as a sculptor. They measured the Pantheon dome, studied other great buildings, and read the works of ancient Romans. Most notably, Vitruvius's Pieni to Classical Proportions, De Architectura. Thus they became embodiments of the multidisciplinary interests and rebirth of classical knowledge that shaped the early Renaissance. To build his cathedral dome, a self-supporting structure of close to 4 million bricks that is still the largest masonry dome in the world, Brunelleschi had to develop sophisticated mathematical modelling techniques and invent an array of hoists and other engineering tools. In an example of the diverse forces that were animating creativity in Florence, some of these hoists were then used to stage Lorenzo de' Medici's magnificent theatrics involving flying characters and moving scenery. Brunelleschi also rediscovered and greatly advanced the classical concepts of visual perspective, which had been missing in the art of the Middle Ages. In an experiment that foreshadowed the work of Leonardo, he painted a panel that depicted the view of the Florence Baptistry across the plaza from the cathedral. After drilling a small hole in the panel, he put the back of it up to his eye while he faced the baptistry. Then he took a mirror and held it at arm's length, reflecting back on the painting. As he moved the mirror in and out of his line of sight, he would compare the reflection of his painting to the real baptistry. The essence of realistic painting, he thought, was to render a three-dimensional view onto a two-dimensional surface. After accomplishing this trick on a painted panel, Brunelleschi showed how parallel lines seem to converge in the distance toward a vanishing point. His formulation of linear perspective transformed art and also influenced the science of optics, the craft of architecture, and the uses of Euclidean geometry. Brunelleschi's successor as a theorist of linear perspective was another of the towering Renaissance polymaths, Leon Battista Alberti, 1404 to 1472, who refined many of Brunelleschi's experiments and extended his discoveries about perspective. An artist, architect, engineer, and writer, Alberti was like Leonardo in many ways. Both were illegitimate sons of prosperous fathers, athletic and good-looking, never married, and fascinated by everything from math to art. One difference is that Alberti's illegitimacy did not prevent him from being given a classical education. His father helped him get a dispensation from the church laws barring illegitimate children from taking holy orders or holding ecclesiastical offices, and he studied law at Bologna, was ordained as a priest, and became a writer for the Pope. During his early 30s, Alberti wrote his masterpiece analyzing painting and perspective, On Painting, the Italian edition of which was dedicated to Brunelleschi. Alberti had an engineer's instinct for collaboration and, like Leonardo, was a lover of friendship and open-hearted, according to the scholar Anthony Grafton. He also honed the skills of courtiership. Interested in every art and technology, he would grill people from all walks of life, from cobblers to university scholars, to learn their secrets. In other words, he was much like Leonardo, except in one respect. Leonardo was not strongly motivated by the goal of furthering human knowledge by openly disseminating and publishing his findings. Alberti, on the other hand, was dedicated to sharing his work, gathering a community of intellectual colleagues who could build on each other's discoveries and promoting open discussion and publication as a way to advance the accumulation of learning. A maestro of collaborative practices, he believed, according to Grafton, in Discourse in the Public Sphere. When Leonardo was a teenager in Florence, Alberti was in his 60s and spending much of his time in Rome, so it is unlikely they spent time together. Alberti was a major influence nonetheless. Leonardo studied his treatises and consciously tried to emulate both his writing and his demeanour. Alberti had established himself as an avatar of grace in every word or movement, a style that very much appealed to Leonardo. "One must apply the greatest artistry in three things," Alberti wrote, "walking in the city, riding a horse, and speaking, for in each of these one must try to please everyone." Leonardo mastered all three. Alberti's On Painting expanded on Brunelleschi's analysis of perspective by using geometry to calculate how perspective lines from distant objects should be captured on a two-dimensional pane. He also suggested that painters hang a veil made of thin thread between themselves and the objects they are painting, then record where each element falls on the veil. His new methods improved not only painting, but endeavours ranging from map-making to stage designs. By applying mathematics to art, Alberti elevated the painter's status and advanced the argument that the visual arts deserved a standing equal to that of other humanist fields, a cause that Leonardo would later champion. Education. Leonardo's only formal learning was at an abacus school, an elementary academy that emphasized the math skills useful in commerce. It did not teach how to formulate abstract theories. The focus was on practical cases. One skill that was emphasized was how to draw analogies between cases, a method that Leonardo would use repeatedly in his later science. Analogies and spotting patterns became for him a rudimentary method of theorizing. His enthusiastic early biographer, Vasari, wrote, with what seems to be typical exaggeration, "In arithmetic, during the few months that he studied it, he made so much progress that by continually suggesting doubts and difficulties to the master who was teaching him, he would very often bewilder him." Vasari also noted that Leonardo was interested in so many things that he got easily distracted. He turned out to be good in geometry, but he never mastered the use of equations or the rudimentary algebra that existed at the time. Nor did he learn Latin. In his 30s, he would still be trying to remedy this deficiency by drawing up lists of Latin words, painstakingly writing out awkward translations, and wrestling with rules of grammar. A left-hander, Leonardo wrote from right to left on a page, the opposite direction of the words on normal pages, and drew each letter facing backwards. "They are not to be read save with a mirror," as Vasari described these pages. Some have speculated that he adopted this script as a code to keep his writing secret, but that is not true. It can be read with or without a mirror. He wrote that way because when using his left hand, he could glide leftward across the page without smudging the ink. The practice was not completely uncommon. When his friend, the mathematician Luca Pacioli, described Leonardo's mirror writing, he made the point that some other left-handers wrote likewise. A popular 15th-century calligraphy book even shows left-handed readers the best way to do lettera mancina, or mirror script. Being left-handed also affected Leonardo's method of drawing. As with his writing, he drew from right to left so as not to smudge the lines with his hand. Most artists draw hatching strokes that slope upward to the right, but Leonardo's hatching was distinctive because his lines started on the lower right and moved upward to the left. Today, this style has an added advantage. The left-handed hatching in a drawing is evidence that it was made by Leonardo. When viewed in a mirror, Leonardo's writing is somewhat similar to that of his father, indicating that Piero probably helped Leonardo learn to write. However, many of his numerical calculations are written in conventional fashion, showing that the Abacus school probably did not indulge his use of mirror script for math. Being left-handed was not a major handicap, but it was considered a bit of an oddity, a trait that conjured up words like sinister and gauche rather than dexterous and adroit. And it was one more way in which Leonardo was regarded, and regarded himself, as distinctive. Verrocchio. Around the time Leonardo was 14, his father was able to secure for him an apprenticeship with one of his clients, Andrea del Verrocchio, a versatile artist and engineer who ran one of the best workshops in Florence. Vasari wrote, "Piero took some of his drawings and carried them to Andrea del Verrocchio, who was his good friend, and asked if he thought it would be profitable for the boy to study drawing." Piero knew Verrocchio well, and he notarized at least 4 legal settlements and rental documents for him around this time. But Verrocchio probably gave the boy an apprenticeship on merit, not just as a favour to his father. He was, Vasari reported, astonished at the boy's talent. Verrocchio's workshop, which was nestled in a street near Piero's notarial office, was the perfect place for Leonardo. Verrocchio conducted a rigorous teaching program that involved studying surface anatomy, mechanics, drawing techniques, and the effects of light and shade on materials such as draperies. When Leonardo arrived, Verrocchio's workshop was creating an ornate tomb for the Medici, sculpting a bronze statue of Christ and St. Thomas, designing banners of white taffeta gilded with flowers of silver and gold for a pageant, curating the Medici's antiques, and generating Madonna paintings for merchants who wanted to display both their wealth and their piety. An inventory of his shop showed that it had a dining table, beds, a globe, and a variety of books in Italian, including translated classical poetry by Petrarch and Ovid, as well as humorous short stories by the 14th-century popular Florentine writer Franco Sacchetti. The topics of discussion in his shop included math, anatomy, dissection, antiquities, music, and philosophy. He applied himself to the sciences and particularly geometry, according to Vasari. Verrocchio's bottega, like those of his five or six main competitors in Florence, was more like a commercial shop, similar to the shops of the cobblers and jewellers along the street, than a refined art studio. On the ground floor was a store and workroom open to the street, where the artisans and apprentices mass-produced products from their easels, workbenches, kilns, pottery wheels and metal grinders. Many of the workers lived and ate together in the quarters upstairs. The paintings and objects were not signed. They were not intended to be works of individual expression. Most were collaborative efforts, including many of the paintings commonly attributed to Verrocchio himself. The goal was to produce a constant flow of marketable art and artifacts rather than nurture creative geniuses yearning to find outlets for their originality. With their lack of Latin schooling, the artisans in such shops were not considered to be part of the cultural elite. But the status of artists was beginning to change. The rebirth of interest in the ancient Roman classics had revived the writings of Pliny the Elder, who extolled classical artists for representing nature so accurately that their grapes could fool birds. With the help of the writings of Alberti and the development of mathematical perspective, the social and intellectual standing of painters was rising, and a few were becoming sought-after names. Trained as a goldsmith, Verrocchio left much of the brushwork of painting to others, most notably a crop of young artists that included Lorenzo di Credi. Verrocchio was a kind master. Students such as Leonardo often continued to live with and work for him after their apprenticeships were completed, and other young painters, including Sandro Botticelli, became part of his circle. Verrocchio's collegial nature did have one downside. He was not a tough taskmaster, and his workshop was not renowned for delivering commissions on time. Vasari noted that Verrocchio once made preparatory drawings for a battle scene of nude figures and other narrative works of art, but for some reason, whatever it may have been, they remained unfinished. Verrocchio held on to some paintings for years before completing them. Leonardo would far exceed his master in all things, including in his propensity to get distracted, walk away from projects, and linger over paintings for years. One of Verrocchio's most captivating sculptures was a 4-foot bronze of the young warrior David, standing in triumph over the head of Goliath. See figure 1 in the PDF. His smile is tantalizing and a bit mysterious. What exactly is he thinking? Like the ones Leonardo would later paint, it quavers between expressing a childlike glory and a dawning realization of future leadership. A cocky smile is caught in the moment of being transformed into resolution. Unlike Michelangelo's iconic marble statue of a muscular David as a man, Verrocchio's David seems to be a slightly effeminate and strikingly pretty boy of about 14. That was the age of Leonardo, newly apprenticed in the studio when Verrocchio probably began work on the statue. Artists of Verrocchio's era typically blended the classical ideal with more naturalistic features, and it is unlikely that his statues are exact portraits of a particular model. Nevertheless, there are reasons to think that Leonardo posed for Verrocchio's David. The face is not the usual broad type that Verrocchio had previously favoured. He clearly used a new model, and the recently arrived boy in the shop was the obvious candidate, especially because, according to Vasari, young Leonardo had a beauty of body beyond description, a splendour that rejoiced the most sorrowful souls. Such praises of young Leonardo's loveliness are echoed by his other early biographers. Another piece of evidence, David's face is similar, strong nose and chin, soft cheeks and lips, to that of a young boy Leonardo drew on the edge of the Adoration of the Magi, that is presumed to be a self-portrait, see figure 2, as well as other supposed likenesses. So with just a little imagination, we can look at Verrocchio's transfixing statue of the pretty boy David and envision what the young Leonardo looked like when he stood modelling on the ground floor of the studio. In addition, there is a drawing by one of Verrocchio's students that is probably a copy of a study made for the statue. It shows the boy model in exactly the same pose, down to his finger placement on his hip and the little hollow where his neck hits his collarbone, but nude. See Figure 3. Verrocchio's art was sometimes criticized as workmanlike. The style of his sculpture and painting tended to be hard and crude, since it came from unremitting study rather than any inborn gift, Vasari wrote. But his statue of David is a beautiful gem that influenced the young Leonardo. David's curls and those of the hair and beard of Goliath's head are luxurious spirals of the type that would become a signature feature of Leonardo's art. In addition, Verrocchio's statue, unlike, say, Donatello's version in 1440, displays a care and mastery of anatomical details. For example, the two veins visible in David's right arm are accurately rendered and pop in just the precise way to show that, despite his seeming nonchalance, he is gripping his dagger-like sword very tightly. Likewise, the muscle connecting David's left forearm to his elbow is flexed in a way that comports with the twisting of his hand. That ability to convey the subtleties of motion in a piece of still art was among Verrocchio's underappreciated talents, one that Leonardo would adopt and then far surpass in his paintings. More than most previous artists, Verrocchio imbued his statues with twists, turns, and flows. In his bronze Christ and St. Thomas, begun while Leonardo was an apprentice, St. Thomas turns to his left to touch the wound of Jesus, who is twisting to his right as he lifts his arm. The sense of motion turns the statue into a narrative. It conveys not merely a moment, but a story, the one told in the Gospel of John, when Thomas doubts the resurrection of Jesus and responds to his injunction, "Reach hither thy hand and thrust it into my side." Kenneth Clark called it the first instance in the Renaissance of that complicated flow of movement through a composition achieved by contrasted axes of the figures, which Leonardo made the chief motif of all his constructions. We can also see Verrocchio's love of movement and flow in the hair of St. Thomas and beard of Jesus, which again feature a sensuous profusion of spiraling curls and tight coils. Leonardo had studied the use of math for commercial purposes at his abacus school, but from Verrocchio he learned something more profound, the beauty of geometry. After Cosimo de' Medici died, Verrocchio designed a marble and bronze slab for his tomb, which was finished in 1467, a year after Leonardo became his apprentice. Instead of religious imagery, the tomb slab featured geometrical patterns dominated by a circle inside a square, as Leonardo would use for his drawing Vitruvian Man. Inside the design, Verrocchio and his workshop carved carefully proportioned rectangles and half circles in colors that were based on harmonic ratios and the Pythagorean musical scale. There was harmony in proportions, Leonardo learned, and math was nature's brushstroke. Geometry and harmony combined again 2 years later when Verrocchio's studio was given a monumental engineering task, mounting a 2-ton ball on top of Brunelleschi's dome of Florence's cathedral. It was a triumph of both art and technology. The crowning moment, which was accompanied by trumpet fanfare and hymns of praise, occurred in 1471 when Leonardo was 19. The project, which he would still refer to decades later in his notebook, ingrained in him a sense of the interplay between artistry and engineering. He made loving, meticulous drawings of the hoists and gear mechanisms that Verrocchio's studio used, some of which had originally been devised by Brunelleschi. The construction of the ball, which was made of stone that was clad with 8 sheets of copper and then gilded, also kindled in Leonardo a fascination with optics and the geometry of light rays. There were no welding torches at the time, so the triangular sheets of copper had to be soldered together using concave mirrors about 3 feet wide that would concentrate sunlight into a point of intense heat. An understanding of geometry was needed to calculate the precise angle of the rays and grind the curve of the mirrors accordingly. Leonardo became mesmerized, at times obsessed, by what he called fire mirrors. Over the years he would make almost 200 drawings in his notebooks that show how to make concave mirrors that will focus light rays from varying angles. Close to 40 years later, when working in Rome on huge curved mirrors that might turn the heat of the sun into a weapon, he jotted in his notebook, "Remember how the ball of Santa Maria del Fiore was soldered together in sections?" Leonardo was also influenced by Verrocchio's primary commercial competitor in Florence, Antonio del Pollaiuolo. Even more than Verrocchio, Pollaiuolo was experimenting with the expression of moving and twisting bodies, and he performed surface dissections of humans to study anatomy. "He was," wrote Vasari, "the first master to skin many human bodies in order to investigate the muscles and understand the nude in a more modern way." In his engraving Battle of the Nudes and his sculpture and painting Hercules and Antaeus, Pollaiuolo depicted warriors contorted in powerful yet realistic ways as they struggle to stab or subdue each other. The anatomy of muscles and nerves informs the grimaces on faces and the twists of limbs. Leonardo's father came to appreciate, and in one case profit from, his son's fevered imagination and ability to connect art to the wonders of nature. A peasant who worked in Vinci one day made a small shield of wood and asked Piero to take it to Florence and have it painted. Piero gave the task to Leonardo, who decided to create a terrifying image of a dragon-like monster breathing fire and belching poison. To make it naturalistic, he assembled parts from real lizards, crickets, snakes, butterflies, grasshoppers, and bats. He labored over it so long that the stench of the dead animals was past bearing, but Leonardo did not notice it. So great was the love that he bore towards art, Vasari wrote. When Piero finally came to get it, he recoiled in shock from what in the dim light appeared at first to be a real monster. Piero decided to keep his son's creation and buy another shield for the peasant. Later, Ser Piero sold the buckler of Leonardo secretly to some merchants in Florence for 100 ducats, and in a short time it came into the hands of the Duke of Milan, having been sold to him by the merchants for 300 ducats. The shield, perhaps Leonardo's first recorded piece of art, displayed his lifelong talent for combining fantasy with observation. In the notes for his proposed treatise on painting, he would later write, "If you wish to make an imaginary animal invented by you appear natural, let us say a dragon, take for the head that of a mastiff or hound, for the eyes a cat, and for the ears a porcupine, and for the nose a greyhound, and the brows of a lion, the temple of an old cock, the neck of a terrapin." Draperies, chiaroscuro, and sfumato. One of the exercises in Verrocchio's studio was the drawing of drapery studies, most done with delicate brushstrokes of black and white washes on linen. According to Vasari, Leonardo would make clay models of figures, draping them with soft pieces of cloth dipped in plaster, and would then draw them patiently on thin sheets of cambric or linen in black and white with the point of the brush. The velvety renderings of the folds and waves of drapery feature deft depictions of light, nuanced gradations of shadow, and the occasional glint of luster. See Figure 4. Some of the drapery drawings from Verrocchio's studio appear to be studies for paintings. Others were probably done just as learning exercises. The drawings have given rise to a vibrant academic industry that tries to sort out which were done by Leonardo and which were more likely by Verrocchio, Ghirlandaio, or their co-workers. The fact that the attributions are difficult to resolve is evidence of the collegial nature of Verrocchio's bottega. For Leonardo, the drapery studies helped foster one of the key components of his artistic genius, the ability to deploy light and shade in ways that would better produce the illusion of three-dimensional volume on a two-dimensional surface. They also helped him hone his ability to observe how light subtly caresses an object, causing a glistening of luster, a sharpened contrast on a fold, or a hint of reflected glow creeping into the heart of a shadow. "The first intention of the painter," Leonardo later wrote, is to make a flat surface display a body as if modelled and separated from this plane, and he who surpasses others in this skill deserves most praise. This accomplishment, with which the science of painting is crowned, arises from light and shade, or we may say, chiaroscuro. That statement could stand as his artistic manifesto, or at least a key element of it. Chiaroscuro, from the Italian for light-dark, is the use of contrasts of light and shadow as a modelling technique for achieving the illusion of plasticity and three-dimensional volume in a two-dimensional drawing or painting. Leonardo's version of the technique involved varying the darkness of a colour by adding black pigments rather than making it a more saturated or richer hue. In his Benoit Madonna, for example, he painted the Virgin Mary's blue dress in shades ranging from almost white to almost black. When mastering drapery drawings in Verrocchio's studio, Leonardo also pioneered sfumato, the technique of blurring contours and edges. It is a way for artists to render objects as they appear to our eye rather than with sharp contours. This advance caused Vasari to proclaim Leonardo the inventor of the modern manner in painting, and the art historian Ernst Gombrich called sfumato Leonardo's famous invention, the blurred outline and mellowed colours that allow one form to merge with another and always leave something to our imagination. The term sfumato derives from the Italian word for smoke, or, more precisely, the dissipation and gradual vanishing of smoke into the air. Your shadows and lights should be blended without lines or borders in the manner of smoke losing itself in the air, he wrote in a series of maxims for young painters. From the eyes of his angel in the baptism of Christ to the smile of the Mona Lisa, the blurred and smoke-veiled edges allow a role for our own imagination. With no sharp lines, enigmatic glances and smiles can flicker mysteriously. Warriors with helmets. In 1471, around the time the copper ball was placed atop the Duomo, Verrocchio and company was involved, as were most of the other artisans of Florence, in the festivities organized by Lorenzo de' Medici for the visit of Galeazzo Maria Sforza, the cruel and authoritarian, and soon to be assassinated, Duke of Milan. Accompanying Galeazzo was his swarthy and charismatic younger brother, Ludovico Sforza, who was 19, the same age as Leonardo. It was to him that Leonardo would address his famous job-seeking letter 11 years later. Verrocchio's shop had two major tasks for the festivities: redecorating the Medici's guest quarters for the visitors, and crafting a suit of armour and an ornate helmet as a gift. The Duke of Milan's cavalcade was dazzling even to Florentines who were used to Medician public spectacles. It included 2,000 horses, 600 soldiers, 1,000 hunting hounds, falcons, falconers, trumpeters, pipers, barbers, dog trainers, musicians, and poets. It's hard not to admire an entourage that travels with its own barbers and poets. Because it was Lent, there were three religious spectacle plays in place of public jousts and tournaments. But the overall atmosphere was far from Lenten. The visit marked the climax of the Medici practice of using public pageants and spectacles to dissipate popular discontent. To Machiavelli, who wrote a history of Florence in addition to his famous how-to manual for authoritarian princes, the penchant for pageantry was related to a decadence that infected Florence during its period of relative peace, when Leonardo was a young artist there. The youth, having become more dissolute than before, more extravagant in dress, feasting and other licentiousness, and being without employment, wasted their time and means on gaming and women, their principal study being how to appear splendid in apparel and attain a crafty shrewdness in discourse. These manners derived additional encouragement from the followers of the Duke of Milan, who, with his duchess and the whole ducal court, came to Florence, where he was received with pomp and respect. One church burned to the ground during the festivities, which was considered divine retribution for the fact that, as Machiavelli wrote, During Lent, when the Church commands us to abstain from animal food, the Milanese, without respect for either God or his Church, ate of it daily. Leonardo's most famous early drawing may have been inspired by or related to this visit by the Duke of Milan. It is of a craggy Roman warrior in profile wearing an ornate helmet, figure 5, and it was derived from a drawing by Verrocchio, whose studio had designed a helmet as one of Florence's gifts to the Duke. Intricately drawn with a silver point stylus on tinted paper, Leonardo's warrior sports a helmet adorned by a frightfully realistic bird wing and the flourishes of curls and spirals that he adored. On the breastplate is a ludicrous but lovable growling lion. The warrior's face is subtly modelled with delicate shadings made by patiently drawn hatch lines, but his jowls and brows and lower lip are exaggerated to the edge of caricature. The hooked nose and jutting jaw create a profile that became a leitmotif in Leonardo's drawings, that of a gruff old warrior, noble but faintly farcical. The influence of Verrocchio can be clearly seen. From Vasari's Lives, we know that Verrocchio created sculptured reliefs of two heads in metal, one representing Alexander the Great in profile, and the other a fanciful portrait of Darius, the ancient Persian king. These are now lost, but are known through various copies made at the time. Most notably, in Washington, D.C.'s National Gallery, there is a marble relief of a young Alexander the Great, attributed to Verrocchio and his workshop, which features a similar ornate helmet with a winged dragon, a breastplate adorned with a roaring face, and the profusion of curls and fluttering swirls that the master imparted to his apprentice. In his own drawing, Leonardo eliminated a large jawed animal that Verrocchio had perched atop the helmet, turned the dragon into swirls of plants, and generally made the design less complicated. What Leonardo's simplifications achieved was to make the beholder's eye focus on the profile heads of the warrior and lion, i.e., on the relationship between the man and the animal, according to Martin Kemp and Giuliana Barone. As with his paired carvings of Darius and Alexander, Verrocchio occasionally juxtaposed a profile of a craggy old warrior with that of a pretty boy, a theme that would become a favourite of Leonardo's, both in his drawings and in random notebook doodles. One example is in Verrocchio's Beheading of St. John the Baptist, a silver relief he did for Florence's baptistry, where a young warrior and an old one are juxtaposed on the far right. By the time this sculpture was made, starting around 1477, when Leonardo was 25, it is unclear who was influencing whom. The young and old warriors facing each other, as well as an angelic young boy on the far left, have the vibrant movement and emotion-laden facial expressions that make it seem possible Leonardo had a hand in them. Pageants and plays. For the artists and engineers in Florence's bottegas, working on the Medici pageants and spectacles was a significant component of their job. For Leonardo, it was also a joy. He was already making a name as a colourful dresser, fond of brocade doublets and rose tunics, and as a showman adept at imaginative theatrics. Over the years, both in Florence and especially after he moved to Milan, he spent time devising costumes, theatrical scenery, stage machinery, special effects, floats, banners, and entertainments. His theatrical productions were ephemeral, and they linger only in sketches in his notebooks. They can be dismissed as diversions, but they were also an enjoyable way for him to combine art and engineering, and thus they became a formative influence on his personality. The artisans who created the sets for theatrical events became masters of the rules of artistic perspective that had been refined in the 1400s. The painted scenery and backdrops had to be unified with the three-dimensional stage settings, props, moving objects, and actors. Reality and illusions were blended. We can see the influence of these plays and pageants on both Leonardo's art and his engineering. He studied how to make the rules of perspective work for different vantage points, loved mixing illusion with reality, and delighted in devising the special effects, costumes, scenery, and theatrical machinery. All of this helps to explain many of the sketches and fantasy writings in his notebooks that scholars sometimes find mystifying. For example, some of the gears and cranks and mechanisms that Leonardo rendered in his notebooks were, I think, theatrical machinery that he encountered or contrived. Florentine impresarios had created ingenious mechanisms called ingegni for changing scenery, propelling dazzling props, and turning stages into living paintings. Vasari praises a Florentine carpenter and engineer who climaxed a festival show with a scene of Christ carried upward from a mountain carved of wood and borne to heaven by a cloud filled with angels. Likewise, some of the flying contraptions that we find in Leonardo's notebooks were probably for the amusement of theatrical audiences. The Florentine plays often involved characters and props descending from the heavens or being magically suspended in air. Some of Leonardo's flying machines were, as we will see, clearly aimed at real human flight. Others, however, are on notebook pages from the 1480s and seem to have a theatrical purpose. They feature wings with limited range, moved by cranks, and they could not possibly have been propelled into the skies by a human pilot. Similar pages include notes on how to project lights onto a scene and drawings of a hook and pulley system to raise actors. Even Leonardo's famous drawing of an aerial screw, figure 6, often touted as the design for the first helicopter, falls into this category of ingegni, devised for a theatrical spectacle, I believe. Its spiral mechanism of linen, wire, and cane was, in theory, supposed to turn and bore upward into the air. Leonardo specified certain details, like making sure the linen has its pores stopped up with starch, but he showed no method for a human to operate it. It is big enough to be amusing, but probably not enough to carry a human. In one model, he specified that the axis will be made of a fine steel blade bent by force, and when released, it will turn the screw. There were toys at the time that used similar mechanisms. Like some of his mechanical birds, the aerial screw was probably made to transport spectators' imaginations rather than their bodies. The Arno Landscape. Leonardo enjoyed the collegial and familial atmosphere in Verrocchio's workshop so much that when his apprenticeship ended in 1472, at the age of 20, he decided to continue to work and live there. He remained on friendly terms with his father, who lived nearby with his second wife and still had no other children. When Leonardo registered as a member of the Florentine painters' confraternity, the Compagnia di San Luca, he affirmed his relationship by signing himself Leonardo di Ser Piero da Vinci. The Compagnia was not a guild, but a club-like mutual aid society or fraternity. Other members who registered and paid dues in 1472 included Botticelli, Pietro Perugino, Ghirlandaio, Pollaiuolo, Filippino Lippi, and Verrocchio himself. The Compagnia had been in existence for a century, but it was undergoing a revitalization partly because artists were reacting against Florence's antiquated guild system. Under the old guild structure, they were lumped into the Arte dei Medici Speciali, which had been founded in 1197 for physicians and pharmacists. By the late 1400s, they were eager to assert a more distinctive status for themselves. Months after becoming a master painter, Leonardo escaped the bustling narrow streets and crammed workshops of Florence and took a trip back to the rolling green hills around Vinci. "I, staying with Antonio, am contented," he scribbled in his notebook in the summer of 1473 when he was 21. His grandfather Antonio had died, so the reference is perhaps to his mother's husband, Antonio Butti, a Catabriga. One can picture him content as he stays with his mother and his large steppe family in the hills just outside of Vinci. It conjures up his tale of the stone that willed itself to roll down to the crowded road, but later yearned to be back up on the quiet hill. On the reverse of that notebook page is what may be Leonardo's earliest surviving art drawing, the shimmering start of a career of combining scientific observation with artistic sensibility. See Figure 7. In his mirror script, he has dated it Day of Holy Mary of the Snows on the 5th August, 1473. The drawing is an impressionistic panorama sketched with quick pen strokes on paper, evoking the rocky hills and verdant valleys surrounding the Arno River near Vinci. There are a few familiar landmarks from the area, a conical hill, perhaps a castle, but the aerial view seems to be, typical of Leonardo, a mix of the actual and the imagined, viewed as if by a soaring bird. The glory of being an artist, he realized, was that reality should inform, but not constrain. If the painter wishes to see beauties that would enrapture him, he is master of their production, he wrote. If he seeks valleys, if he wants to disclose great expanses of countryside from the summits of mountains, and if he subsequently wishes to see the horizon of the sea, he is lord of all of them. Other artists had drawn landscapes as backdrops, but Leonardo was doing something different, depicting nature for its own sake. That makes his Arno Valley drawing a contender for the first such landscape in European art. The geological realism is striking. The craggy rock outcroppings eroded by the river reveal accurately rendered layers of stratified rock, a subject that was to fascinate Leonardo for the rest of his life. So too is the near precision of linear perspective and the way the atmosphere blurs the distant horizon, an optical phenomenon that he would later call aerial perspective. Even more arresting is the young artist's ability to convey motion. The leaves of the trees and even their shadows are drawn with quick curved lines that make them seem to tremble in the breeze. The water falling into a pool is made vibrant with flutters of quick strokes. The result is a delightful display of the art of observing movement. Tobias and the Angel. While working as a master painter in Verrocchio's shop during his late teens and early 20s, Leonardo contributed elements to two paintings. He was responsible for the scampering dog and shiny fish in Tobias and the Angel, and for the angel on the far left in The Baptism of Christ. These collaborations show what he learned from Verrocchio and how he then surpassed him. See Figure 8, Tobias and the Angel. The biblical tale of Tobias, which was popular in late 15th century Florence, tells of a boy who is sent by his blind father to collect a debt, accompanied by his guardian angel, Raphael. On the journey, they catch a fish, the guts of which turn out to have healing powers, including that of restoring the father's sight. Raphael was the patron saint of travellers and of the Guild of Physicians and Apothecaries. The tale of him and Tobias was particularly appealing to the wealthy merchants who had become art patrons in Florence, especially those with travelling sons. Among the Florentines who painted it were Pollaiuolo, Verrocchio, Filippino Lippi, Botticelli, and Francesco Botticini, seven times. Pollaiuolo's version, Figure 9, was produced in the early 1460s for the Church of Or San Michele. It was well known to Leonardo and Verrocchio, who was sculpting his statue of Christ and St. Thomas for a niche of that church's wall. In producing his own Tobias and the Angel a few years later, Verrocchio engaged in an explicit competition with Pollaiuolo. The version that came out of Verrocchio's shop includes the exact same elements as Pollaiuolo's. Tobias and the Angel walking hand in hand, a Bolognese terrier scampering alongside, Tobias holding a carp on a stick and strings, and Raphael holding a tin with the fish's guts, all in front of a meandering river landscape with clumps of grass and clusters of trees. And yet, it is a fundamentally different painting, in both its impact and detail, in ways that reveal what Leonardo was learning. One difference is that Pollaiuolo's version is stiff, while Verrocchio's conveys movement. As a sculptor, he had mastered the twists and thrusts that impart dynamism to a body. His Tobias leans in as he strides, his cloak billowing out behind him while tassels and threads flutter. He and Raphael turn to each other naturally. Even the way they hold hands is more dynamic. Whereas Pollaiuolo's faces seem vacuous. The body motions in the Verrocchio version connect to emotional expressions, conveying mental as well as physical movements. Verrocchio, who was more of a sculptor than a painter, developed a reputation for not being a master at portraying nature. True, there is a good raptor sweeping down in his Baptism of Christ, but his way with animals was generally considered indifferent and deficient. So it is not surprising that to paint the fish and dog he would turn to his pupil Leonardo, whose eye for nature was proving to be astonishing. Both animals are painted on what was already a finished background landscape. We know this because, as sometimes happened with Leonardo's experimental mixtures, his paint has become somewhat transparent. The shiny and shimmery scales of the fish show that Leonardo was already mastering the magic of how light strikes an object and dances to our eyes. Each scale is a gem. The sunshine, coming from the top left of the picture, produces a mix of light and shade and sparkle. Both behind the gill and at the front of the liquidy eye is a spot of luster. Unlike other painters, Leonardo even took care to render the blood dripping from the fish's cut belly. As for the dog prancing just under Raphael's feet, it has an expression and personality that matches in its charm that of Tobias. In stark contrast to Pollaiuolo's stiff terrier, Leonardo's trots naturally and watches alertly. Most notable are its curls. Their painstaking design and lustrous lighting match that of the curls above Tobias's ear, which, an analysis of the left-handed style shows, were also drawn by Leonardo. Swirling and flowing curls, perfectly lit and coiled, were becoming a Leonardo signature. In this deeply pleasing and sprightly painting, we can see the power of a master-pupil collaboration. Leonardo was already an extreme observer of nature, and he was perfecting the ability to convey the effects of light on objects. Added to that, he had imbibed from Verrocchio, the master sculptor, the excitement of conveying motion and narrative. Baptism of Christ. The culmination of Leonardo's collaborations with Verrocchio came in the mid-1470s with the completion of The Baptism of Christ, which shows John the Baptist pouring water over Jesus while two angels kneeling beside the River Jordan watch. See figure 10. Leonardo painted the radiant turning angel on the far left of the scene, and Verrocchio was so awed when he beheld it that he resolved never again to touch a brush. Or at least, that's what Vasari tells us. Even allowing for Vasari's penchant to mythologize and trot out cliched themes, there was probably some truth to the tale. Afterward, Verrocchio never completed any new painting on his own. More to the point, a comparison between the parts of the Baptism of Christ that Leonardo painted with those done by Verrocchio shows why the older artist would have been ready to defer. An X-ray analysis of the painting confirms that the angel on the left and much of the background landscape and the body of Jesus were painted with multiple thin layers of oil paint, the pigments highly diluted, stroked on with great delicacy and sometimes dabbed and smoothed by fingertips, a style that Leonardo was developing in the 1470s. Oil painting had come to Italy from the Netherlands, and Pollaiuolo's workshop was using it, as was Leonardo. Verrocchio, on the contrary, never embraced the use of oils, and instead continued to use tempera, a mix of water-soluble pigments bound with egg yolks. The most striking trait of Leonardo's angel is the dynamism of his pose. Shown from slightly behind, in a twisted three-quarter profile, his neck turns to the right as his torso twists slightly to the left. Always set your figures so that the side to which the head turns is not the side to which the breast faces, since nature, for our convenience, has made us with a neck which bends with ease in many directions, Leonardo wrote in one of his notebooks. As evident in his Christ and St. Thomas, Verrocchio was a master of depicting motion in sculptures, and Leonardo became an expert in its painterly conveyance. A comparison of the two angels shows how Leonardo was surpassing his master. Verrocchio's angel seems vacant, his face flat, and his only emotion seems to be a sense of wonder that he happens to find himself next to a much more expressive angel. He seems to look with astonishment at his companion, as at a visitant from another world, Kenneth Clark wrote. And, in fact, Leonardo's angel belongs to a world of the imagination, which Verrocchio's never penetrated. Like most artists, Verrocchio drew lines to delineate the contours of his angel's head and face and eyes. But in Leonardo's angel, there are no clear edges that delineate the features. The curls dissolve gently into each other and the face, rather than creating a hairline. Look at the shadow underneath the jaw of Verrocchio's angel, done with visible brushstrokes of tempera paint that create a sharp jawline. Then, look at Leonardo's. The shadow is more translucent and blends more smoothly, something that's easier done with oil. The almost imperceptible strokes are fluid, thinly layered, and occasionally smoothed by hand. The contours of the angel's face are soft. There are no perceptible edges. We can also see this beauty in the body of Jesus. Compare his legs, painted by Leonardo, with those of Verrocchio's John the Baptist. The latter have sharper lines, unlike what a careful observer would see in reality. Leonardo even minutely blurs the curls of Jesus' exposed pubic hair. This use of sfumato, the smokiness that blurs sharp contours, was by now a hallmark of Leonardo's art. Alberti, in his treatise on painting, had advised that lines should be drawn to delineate edges, and Verrocchio did just that. Leonardo took care to observe the real world, and he noticed the opposite. When we look at three-dimensional objects, we don't see sharp lines. Paint so that a smoky finish can be seen, rather than contours and profiles that are distinct and crude, he wrote. When you paint shadows and their edges, which cannot be perceived except indistinctly, do not make them sharp or clearly defined, otherwise your work will have a wooden appearance. Verrocchio's angel has this wooden appearance. Leonardo's does not. X-ray analysis shows that Verrocchio, with his lesser feel for nature, had originally begun the background by drawing a few rounded clumps of trees and bushes more wooden than sylvan. When Leonardo took over, he used oils to paint a richly natural view of a languid but sparkling river flowing through rocky cliffs, echoing his Arno River drawing and foreshadowing the Mona Lisa. Other than Verrocchio's pedestrian palm tree, the backdrop displays a magical mix of natural realism and creative fantasia. The geological striations of the rock, except those on the far right, which someone else must have painted, are carefully rendered, though not with the subtlety that Leonardo would later display. As the scene recedes, it gradually blurs, as our eyes would naturally have it, into a hazy horizon where the blue of the sky whitens into the mists just above the hills. The edges of the mist will be indistinct against the blue of the sky, and towards the earth it will look almost like dust blown up, Leonardo wrote in one of his notebooks. In painting the background and foreground, Leonardo created the organizing theme of the picture, which is a narrative united by the meandering river. He portrayed the water's movement with scientific mastery and spiritual profundity, imbuing it with metaphorical power as the lifeblood connecting the macrocosm of the earth and the microcosm in humans. The water flows from the heavens and distant lakes, cuts through rocks to form dramatic cliffs and smooth pebbles, and pours from the cup of the Baptist as if connecting to the blood of his veins. Finally, it swaddles the feet of Jesus and ripples to the edge of the picture, reaching us and making us feel a part of the flow. There is an inexorable impetus to the water's flow, and when it is obstructed by the ankles of Jesus, it forms swirls and eddies as it proceeds along its course. In these acutely observed vortexes and scientifically accurate ripples, Leonardo delights in what will become his favorite pattern, nature's spirals. The curls flowing down his angel's neck look like cascades of water, as if the river had flowed over his head and transformed into hair. At the center of the picture is a small waterfall, one of many such depictions Leonardo would produce in his paintings and notebooks of water falling into a swirling pool or stream. Sometimes these renderings are scientific, at other times darkly hallucinatory. In this case, the falling water seems sprightly. It causes splashes that prance around the eddies like Tobias's puppy. With the baptism of Christ, Verrocchio went from being Leonardo's teacher to being his collaborator. He had helped Leonardo learn the sculptural elements of painting, especially modelling, and also the way a body twists in motion. But Leonardo, with thin layers of oil both translucent and transcendent, and his ability to observe and imagine, was now taking art to an entirely different level. From the mist on the distant horizons, to the shadow under the angel's chin, to the water at the feet of Christ, Leonardo was redefining how a painter transforms and transmits what he observes. The Annunciation. In addition to the collaborations he did with Verrocchio in the 1470s, the 20-something Leonardo produced at least 4 paintings primarily on his own while working at the studio. An Annunciation, 2 small devotional paintings of the Madonna and Child, and a pioneering portrait of a Florentine woman, Ginevra de Benci. Paintings of the Annunciation, which portray the moment when the angel Gabriel surprised the Virgin Mary by telling her that she would become the Mother of Christ, were very popular in the Renaissance. Leonardo's version depicts the announcement and reaction as a narrative occurring in a walled garden of a stately country villa, as Mary looks up from reading a book. See Figure 11. Although ambitious, the painting is so flawed that its attribution to Leonardo has been debated. Some experts contend that it was the product of an awkward collaboration with Verrocchio and others in his shop. But a variety of evidence shows that Leonardo was the primary, if not sole, artist. He made a preparatory drawing of Gabriel's sleeve, and the painting exhibits his trademark style of dabbing the oil paint with his hands. His finger smudges can be seen on very close inspection on the Virgin Mary's right hand and on the leaves of the base of the lectern. Among the problematic elements of the picture is the bulky garden wall, which seems to be viewed from a slightly higher vantage point than the rest of the picture and distracts from the visual connection between the angel's pointing fingers and Mary's raised hand. It has an odd angle at its opening, which makes it look like it is being viewed from the right and is jarring when compared to the wall of the house. The cloths covering the Virgin's lap have a rigidity, as if Leonardo had worked on his drapery studies a little too fastidiously, and the odd configuration of what I assume is her armchair makes it seem as if she has 3 knees. Her pose makes her look like a mannequin, an effect that is compounded by the blankness of her expression. The flatly rendered cypress trees are the same size, yet the one on the right, next to the house, seems closer to us and thus should be bigger. A spindly trunk of one of the cypresses seems to sprout from the angel's fingers, and the botanical exactness of the Madonna lily that the angel holds contrasts with the generic treatment of the other plants and grasses that is untypical of Leonardo. The most discomforting lapse involves the awkward positioning of Mary in relation to the ornate lectern, which was based on a tomb Verrocchio designed for the Medici. The lectern's base is a few feet closer to the viewer than Mary is, which makes it seem that she is too far away for her right arm to reach the book, yet her arm extends across it, appearing oddly elongated. This is clearly the work of a young artist. The Annunciation gives us an insight into what type of painter Leonardo